Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Nerds and geeks, hold on to your seats because it's about to go down.
Welcome to Nerdorama, the voice of the Nerd Nation. I'm Mo Kelly, he's Tawala Sharp, and together we bring you your daily dose of nerd news, analysis, and conversations with the best and brightest of the nerdverse. Everyone knows who Wonder Woman is, but not everyone knows her black twin sister. Say what? Yes, Nubia. Originally Wonder Woman's long-lost twin sister, Nubia has since variously been presented as a non-sibling Amazon contemporary of Wonder Woman, as a parallel universe version of the hero, and as an inheritor of the Wonder Woman mantle in a future timeline, first debuting back in 1973. Acclaimed YA author L.L. McKinney and artist Robin Smith have released their first graphic novel, Nubia, Real One, that brings the female superhero back into the spotlight, and they both join me now. Let me first say, L, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
And Robin, thank you as well for joining us.
Yeah, of course.
This first question is for both of you. Not that we had social media back in 1973, but I can imagine the character of Nubia likely created a stir for its time. A long-lost black twin of Diana Prince. How do you think, or maybe how do you know, how was Nubia originally received?
I know that it was something of a surprise to people, but at the same time, this was after a really long run of Diana as Maud Wonder Woman, you know? So people were really happy to see Diana back as, you know, the Wonder Woman that people remembered prior to that run. So when this happened, it was on top of that, so that initial excitement built. And people were both excited. Some people were confused. Of course, you know, there were people who were like,
of course,
they tend to be sometimes. But I like to imagine that for a number of fans who just love Wonder Woman and the mythos, that this was another opportunity to expand on the story in ways that hadn't been before.
Robin, I got to ask you, as an artist and illustrator, how did you first come across Nubia, and how did she figure into, I would say, the overall archetype or even expectation of black female superheroes?
So it's interesting that you ask about it like that, because my introduction to Nubia was through research, because I was doing a lot of study into the representation of like black people in superhero comics. So that's actually why I like worked on for my undergrad thesis. And I came across Nubia, who I'd never heard of before. And I was kind of like stunned. And most of the like research I did about her at that time was mostly around the fact that blaxploitation films at the time, that sort of was trending, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So the introduction of like this black twin sister Wonder Woman had that sort of like surprise, but also fit in with that trope of kind of popular culture at the time. And I mean, as it pertains to how like black women are especially portrayed as superheroes at the time, definitely it fit in more with the sort of paralleling them with like animalistic sort of. Nubia is presented wearing like cheetah skin. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of black women superheroes over like throughout history have also been presented that same way, how they're compared to like slinky animal, if that makes sense. So, I mean, I'm glad to see where she is now, of course, but that's more of the history that I know about like the very first Nubia.
L, I think that leads me into my next question, because we live in a time in which there is heightened scrutiny in how female superheroes are portrayed, how they're drawn, how they're clothed, all that. Robin touches upon all that. Did you have any concerns or goals going in trying to tell this story about Nubia, but beyond the story, how she would be presented and perceived by the world?
I mean, I did. I always feel protective of any of the Black characters that I write about, just because people are going to have their preconceived notions of, you know, you trying to have an agenda or trying to force diversity or assigning things to them that people don't realize. These are pretty stereotypical, like harmful tropes that maybe you're not aware of in your reactions. So I'm always not precious about it because people are going to critique your work. That's just part of the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in going in with Nubia, that's one of the reasons why I was adamant in having Black women on the team in creating her. Because I knew that, I mean, just to put it no other way, we're the only ones who have our backs sometimes. So I knew the best thing I could do for the character was put her in the hands that would care for her most.
But doesn't that also add to the fullness of the experience of a Black woman and what she may deal with within a particular storyline in which you are endeavoring to write?
Oh, absolutely. I'm 100% assured that the reason people are reacting to Nubia the way that they are is because of Robin's artwork and everybody else's colors. Like, you can take my words away from this book and you would still get the feeling and the emotion and the gist of the story, honestly. The pictures tell the story on their own. My words are not needed. It doesn't work the other way around. So just knowing, not necessarily for protection, but absolutely for knowing that it would be done right, that there would be care, that there would be an authenticity in just how these characters are drawn and how they interact with each other, would be there. Like, they're that's why this book is the way that it is, and it's been received the way that it's been received. It's wholeheartedly the team that put the art together. Absolutely.
Robin, let's get into how you created this story in the sense of the visual aspect. Did you take the words that Elle had and then start creating the visuals, or did you start creating the visuals just around maybe like a treatment of the story?
So the first time I actually sent in any sketches at all was a sample script of some sort. So Elle, of course, was still like way ahead on the writing aspect of the comic. And I sort of came in after that. And I ended up designing the characters and the backgrounds and where she lived and her family mostly based off of just those two pages I had from Elle, because it's funny that she talks about, oh, you know, there is so much of it that is drawing, which is true. But even the descriptions around like how the friends interact or how like the group of them interact or just describing like the mood, all of that is so important in writing a comic. And I feel like that's what a lot of readers don't see in the writing aspect and how important that is to the illustrator. So, I mean, it was then fully like fleshed out more, of course, after getting like the outline more and getting even more of a vibe for who Nubia was and who Keisha was and Jason, and which, I mean, is the main like friend group, and even who her like moms were. All of that was really important to me. And I like spent a lot of time developing their characters because character design is, I think, the most important aspect of creating a comic.
Elle, let's talk about your writing, this story. And as I look at the cover of the graphic novel, Nubia Real One, you're not presenting her as some sort of sex symbol. You're presenting her as someone who's very confident. And for people who can't see it, she's like sitting on a chair and her legs are apart with her hands clasped in between. She's sitting in a very confident position with her hair, which is full and beautiful and flowing. It goes against archetype as far as how many superheroes are presented. Let's get into the story now.
I remember seeing the cover concepts for the first time. When I get any art from Robin, it was always a treat. And there were a few different poses. And this is the one that I think all of us just gravitated towards individually and then as a collective. Because she's got the tilt. You can see like the nails and the shirt and the hair and the look on her face where she's both exuding like that confidence that you were talking about, where she's like, this is who I am, try and tell me otherwise.
Right.
But it was, I remember just the feeling of seeing this. And I was like, that's it. That's the one. That's our girl. And there's a scene and there's a page out there that's available where Nubia is getting ready to go to a protest, right? And if I recall correctly, it was something along the lines of, you know, she does her hair, she gets these clothes, she does all this other stuff, trying to get ready. And then she comes back with the pictures where she's braiding her hair back.
Yes.
I'm like, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, you pulled it out. Just like, I didn't have to explain things.
Mm-hmm.
And it just the same magic, because we did the cover either at the end or really close to the end. And at that time, Robin is just like, these characters are alive and I'm being told my story back to me as if I'm reading it for the first time. That's how this art made me feel. Like, I had handed over the script, but when I got it back, there were layers there. I don't even know how to describe it. I guess the best way to describe it is like when you go to a movie, you go to see the movie about a book you've already read, you know what's going to happen, but there's mm-hmm. new and exciting ways that it's being presented to you. This was like that.
This is something that I think, or I think this resonates with more and more people. When I look at that cover, I look at a superhero who is eminently relatable, who is living in our world, dealing with things that we are dealing with in this time and space. And many superheroes today, not calling out any names, don't live in our world. They do live in a fantastical world in dealing with things that we don't have to deal with on any level. We can't relate, where Nubia is actually among us, if you will. How do you think that speaks to this generation specifically? That question is for either of you.
I know, like, there's something about representation, whether or not the world is fantastical, that's really important. But seeing it, like, as down to earth as possible, like, literally things you do every day, like, just going to the store, seeing your friends, like, going to a party, the things that you do, like, it was basically just calling on my own experiences and my friends' own experiences. And that's what I wanted for the cover. Actually, for the cover, I kind of just recorded myself sitting in different positions that I felt most comfortable in, but also felt like I was taking up a lot of space
mm-hmm.
and moving sort of the camera around to get different angles. And, you know, I then even like in the moment thinking about like the way that I'm moving and what makes me comfortable, that moves throughout the whole book, because it's actually like all my friends, my family, especially who I base Nubia on.
El, this last question is going to be for you. And I think we cannot have this conversation and not acknowledge the timing of it being against the backdrop of the recent release of the movie Wonder Woman 1984 and the expansion of that tentpole franchise. No pressure here, but any likelihood that we might be able to see Nubia on the big screen? I mean, they've shown an extensive amount of Themyscira. Why not include Nubia?
So I wish I had an answer. Truth is, I don't. And I know people will sometimes be like, well, you're on the inside. Like, is it something that you know and you can't talk about? No, y'all, I literally don't know anything about what's going on outside of the Nubia stories that I write.
Well, let me
if
ask it a different way.
I know.
Okay, let me ask it a different way. Don't you think that raising the profile of Nubia can only help?
Absolutely.
All right.
If I got my way, there would be multiple Nubia centered comics running at the same time, because everyone else gets it, so mm-hmm. why can't she? There would be animated series for kids and for adults, because those are happening, and there would be movies, there would be animated movies, like, she would be everywhere. And I'm hoping that with essentially Wonder Woman leading the charge in the movies, at least in this moment with the DCEU, that we get Nubia at some point, and we get her in her original state, because I love Nubia. I am here for all iterations of her, but I have always been a fan who was upset at how the original Nubia just sort of got wiped off the face of the earth with the, you know, crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
And now being able to see her back as Diana's twin, as, you know, with her original powers and everything, is just, it's amazing. I really didn't think I would see it anytime soon, and to be a part of it, that was completely beyond my scope. Like, I still have to pinch myself sometimes.
But that's the beautiful thing. She is L.L. McKinney. Also, you heard Robin Smith, who's an artist and illustrator for Nubia Real One. They're bringing this female superhero back into the spotlight. L. Robin, thank you so much for coming on today. I wish you nothing but great success with Nubia Real One. And I know you may not know what the future may bring for the character, but I'm hoping to see more of Nubia, not only in graphic novels, but also, as you said, animated series. I want to see her on the big screen because more Nubia is good for everyone.
Very true.
Yeah.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to the BiPal, the only online comic book review column that's haunted by the notion that somewhere there's a love in flames. My name is Hannibal Taboo, and you can find everything you need to know about me on social media, be that Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, MySpace, Black Planet, Your Planet, My Planet, Planet Soul. Hard to know. Anyway, using @ H-A-N-N-I, B as in bounce, A-L, T as in tough, A, B as in bounce, U, or you can check over at HannibalTaboo.com. Thanks again to Tawala and Mo for having me here. And let's get into the comics for the week that was February 17th, 2021. There are four sections to the BiPile. The first section is the titular BiPile, as noted, where books are either purchased in the moment because they're so amazing that they cannot be left in the store, or they come from a series of books that have been so great that they demand to maintain this purchased spot until three not-so-purchase-worthy issues go by. I'm sorry to say there's nothing in that category this week, which is not a good start for us, but hey, you know, you got to do something about something. Next is the honorable mention slot for books that were, well, I mean, they're okay, but, you know, they may not have had enough quality to get your actual money out of your actual wallet. I'm also sorry to say, there's nothing in that category this week. Yikes. Okay, well, moving on. The third section of our review is called the Meh Pile for books that, I mean, they happen. They were either points where the good and the bad washed themselves out in a dull gray cloud of indifference, or where, you know, they didn't leave much of an impression. There's one worth talking about this week. There'll be a few more that we'll discuss, but the one that I wanted to talk about was Hollow Heart number one, which is definitely a mixed bag situation. From Vault Comics with the creative team of Paul Allor and Paul Tucker. And yes, I wondered if it was confusing to have everybody on the book named Paul. Anyway, this is messed up, y'all. Like one of those deeply messed up things you read on Twitter that's unmistakably, irredeemably wrong, but also completely outside of your control, like, you know, the death of Ayanna Stanley Jones or the Snyder Cut. There's a deep poignancy to the events here, but at what cost indeed? There's a sentient being called L, because those are the letters on the front of the exoskeleton he wears, as the technical designation for this person is subject EL-15C. Once, L was a human being. Now, L is a sack of loose organs in a gigantic metal suit being kept alive by some weird paramilitary force in a creepy science fiction base. From a certain point of view, L is trying to escape and wants out of this horror show, surrounded by cruel people and horrible conditions. Then, L meets Mateo. Mateo is a mechanic, assigned to fix damage to L's exoskeleton. Mateo, like most people working on the Death Star, probably, is just a guy doing his job. Mateo, though, shows kindness to L, and things start to get depressing. Writer Paul Allor has delivered a script that ably captures the pain and grimness of the situation, with a faceless bureaucracy determined to achieve its goals no matter the cost. Mateo is conflicted when he recognizes what's going on at this horrible place and struggles with what his morals tell him to do in the face of what his actual job is. The art is 100% in the hands of Paul Tucker, and he has great deftness at visual storytelling, even if the actual details of it are just pretty good. If you're up for the tragic likes of Handmaid's Tale, well, this might work for you. If the horror of feeling like we're still trapped in 2020 is too much for you, maybe not. That rating would be meh. There were some even less mention-worthy meh books this week, like Bite Size number 3, or Batman Catwoman number 3, Future State Catwoman number 2, which was a real disappointment because the issue before was a little more peppy, but whatever. Future State, Immortal Wonder Woman number 2, which really just need to cut to the Nubia backup. Future State, Superman Worlds at War. I don't know. I really want to love the Mr. Miracle backup, but it's so out of order, I can't really understand which way I'm supposed to read it because it was published all out of order. Future State, The Next Batman, number 4. Excellence, number 10, which had amazing art, at least. I can definitely say that. Black Widow, number 5. Captain America, number 27. Champions, number 4. Guardians of the Galaxy, number 11. Immortal Hulk, Flatline, number 1. I was very disappointed that Iron Fist, Heart of the Dragon, number 2 kind of fell down because it didn't really complete itself in this issue, whereas the first issue was a complete story. It was disappointing. And X-Men Legends, number 1. You know, but whatever. All right, so those are the books that were in the meh pile. The next section of our reviews is called No, Just No, and it's for books that are abjectly horrible and should not be purchased under any circumstance. I'm sorry to say there are 3 books here, so strap in, kids. It's about to be wild. First, oh boy. King in Black, number 4, from Marvel Comics with the creative team of Donny Cates, Ryan Stegman, J.P. Mayer, Frank Martin, and Clayton Cowles. As this mega crossover comes to a climax, things look pretty dire for the citizens of planet Earth. Dylan Brock, son of longtime symbiote partner Eddie Brock, doing business as Venom, or Anti-Venom most of the time, has been captured by Null, ancient interstellar god of symbiotes and being boring. It is at this time that, at long last, the long con that lay at the center of this story finally becomes apparent and ties things together in a way that almost makes sense. There's no use spoiling the reveal here, but longtime Marvel fans will recognize the Hail Mary play that comes into the narrative, whether envisioned by writer Donny Cates or merely executed by him, and recognize what this means. In a way, oddly enough, it echoes the words of meaty sock puppet Snoke, who said, "Darkness rises, and the light to meet it." What's funniest about it, in many ways, is how much Sturm und Drang is put into freeing the likes of Thor or Storm from the grasp of Null to recognize that even gods are pawns in this game, and somewhat inconsequential in the end analysis. Admittedly, if the aforementioned Hail Mary were heralded as a big play early on, there's no way the sales would stand up to scrutiny. But making the ultimate endgame, no pun intended, for Eddie Brock's twisted saga has a kind of awkward poetry to it. For all the vast tableaus of goop and teeth, Ryan Stegman, J.P. Mayer, Frank Martin, and Clayton Cowles do admirable work in showing facial expressions and making 2 big moments, for a man and a woman separately, stick the landing. A lengthy flashback is meant to reveal the one thing Noel might be worried about, and if he had Google, he'd realize this planet is a terrible place to avoid it. It's a bit overwrought, especially with a Geoff Johns riff that some might recognize at the end, but serviceable in the way a Michael Bay film would be. As boring as the crossover has been, by and large, this issue gingerly stepped towards adequacy. Was that enough? Well, if you love Venom and the big-scale mash-em-up, sure. This is not, however, a tale that will leave its shadow across the continuity, like, say, Age of Apocalypse, or deeply influence things for years to come, like, say, Heroes Reborn, for ill or not. The Hail Mary has never historically left much of an impression, or Reed Richards might have been a little less surprised to see it coming. You know what? I'm going to back this up. In retrospect, that rating is meh. So, yay. Back to the No Just No, we have next up Future State Shazam number 2 from DC Comics with the creative team of Tim Sheridan, Eduardo Panseca, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Julio Ferreira, Marcelo Maiolo, and Rob Lee. In a wildly disappointing turn of events, Earth's mightiest mortal is revealed to be a fool after, I'm not supposed to use that word, let's call him a sucker. After dancing with the devil and ending the arc of one of comics' most beloved heroes in one of the most depressing possible ways. This issue fails at the level of conception because from an execution standpoint, the creative team hits their marks admirably enough. The final product, however, is far from satisfying. Here's the gag. In order to imprison a grandiose danger to the world inside the Rock of Eternity, Billy Batson has split himself from his superheroic alter ego, leaving Billy chained to a locked door in H.E. Double Hockey Sticks, and his muscle-bound form headed back to be a hero on Earth. This, of course, went wrong even with the wisdom of Solomon, because Shazam started murdering people in secret, only to be discovered and captured by his teammates in the Justice League. The artwork by Eduardo Panseca, Julio Ferreira, Marcelo Maiolo, and Rob Lee ably captures the hellscape of a field of demons waiting for their queen to arrive, as well as it shows an impatient vixen or a legendary power coming out to play. All that looks fine. Unfortunately, there's no point in Tim Sheridan's script where you want Shazam to win, where he displays heroism or courage or power or anything that would endear him to the reader. To be blunt, Shazam is a sucker, played for a patsy in almost every panel. It's hard to sit through, honestly. It was nice to see what's apparently Power Girl, the black one, return from the dead, but the Justice League fares no better at understanding what's happening as they are for falling for a long con. This is not a future to look forward to, so their rating is no, just no. The last book we'll review is Thor number 12 from Marvel Comics with the creative team of Donny Cates, Nick Klein, Matt Wilson, and Joe Sabino. There's no real way to tiptoe around the truth here. This issue is not good. Everybody involved are all skilled craftspeople who have made impressive comics work before, but this is a mess, with issues of internal logic that ring false, as well as visually muddy sequences that are supposed to be combat, but just look like implications. First of all, let's look at the meat of the matter. For most of the issue, Donald Blake fights Throg, the Frog of Thunder, and his pal from the Inhumans, the teleporting giant dog Lockjaw. Why? Well, he wants revenge on everyone touched by Odin's power to bear the mantle of Thor, leaving Blake trapped in a bad 1950s sitcom for years, even if they literally had nothing to do with it. It was Odin all along. Anyway, sorry. No spoiler there. Pretty typical privileged behavior, honestly, lashing out and blaming others when the source of the issue is not available. Then, well, here's the thing. An issue or two back, Donald Blake, wielding all the power of the Midgard Serpent, who he sucker-punched and siphoned like a gas tank, Thor, and all the power of Odin, which Thor received from Odin, and Blake subsequently yoinked it all, fought literally everybody in Asgard and killed most of them in less time than it takes to complete an issue. Sif, Warriors 3, Baldur, everybody, murked in like a few pages. That's on the record. So now, for 10 consecutive pages, Donny Cates' script has Odin slash Thor-powered Blake, just go with it, fighting Throg and Lockjaw. The entire forces of Asgard couldn't keep him busy for half an issue, but these two do. Considering the transitive property, either that means Throg and Lockjaw are bananas powerful, or the amassed might of Asgard is drastically less impressive than their marketing would have us believe. 10 pages. Wow. Let's talk about the fight for a second. Lockjaw is clutch here as Blake uses the power of the Rainbow Bridge, which he repossessed from Sif, the replacement for Heimdall, to reenact the fight scene from Jumper, sort of. The artistic choice of montaging the fight and using close-ups on the bridge and Lockjaw's little tuning fork on his head take the fight from Giza, Egypt, to what's probably the Savage Land, to some desolate world. It's a mess, y'all. It's hard to tell if the choice for that came from the script or from Nick Klein, Matt Wilson, and Joe Sabino. This is just not working. The whole underlying concept of Thor's limping alter ego leveling up so far is pretty ridiculous. But this is drifting into ambush levels of incredulity. Frog y'all, wow. So that rating would be no, just no. With so much problematic work at the bottom of the heap, it really makes it difficult to say this week was anything less than a stinker. So let's check back in next time and see if things go a little bit better. Again, thanks to Mo and Tuala for having me here. My name is Hannibal Taboo. This is The Bi-Pal, and I will talk to you next week.
Hey guys, Mo Kelly here. The new Daily Nerdorama podcast is featured on iHeartRadio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast feed to get your daily dose of nerd news. Also available on iTunes, Spreaker, and all the top podcasting apps. It's free and perfect for everyone in your nerd family.
Nerdorama is produced by Tuala Sharp and continues to be a segment on The Mo Kelly Show. Weekends on KFI Los Angeles. Hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Nerdorama News.
Until next time, keep it comic.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.